From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, music streaming services are singing a sad tune after songwriters receive a royalties boost. Then playwright Jez Butterworth from The Ferryman on how a single set adds tension to a story.
I just like the idea and the challenge and the tightrope walk of staying in one place and allowing it to steep and to boil and just create this kind of pressure cooker environment.
And Captain Marvel's composer shares her early voice memo recordings for the movie's theme song. All that coming up on today's edition of The Frame. Songwriters make pennies on the dollar each time their music is streamed. And with streaming making up about 75% of the music business in the United States, they not surprisingly want a better cut. So songwriters were pleased when last year the Copyright Royalty Board decided to boost their streaming royalties from 10% to about 15%. But reports this week say that Spotify, Google, Amazon, and Pandora want to appeal that decision. To find out why, I spoke with Lucas Shaw from the Bloomberg Newsroom, where he reports on the entertainment business, and he said the dispute started with the Music Modernization Act, a law passed last year which set up a new framework for how songwriters would get paid.
While it's fairly easy to know who recorded a song, the songwriting can get really messy because you're sometimes factoring in samples. You oftentimes have 7 or 8 or 9 different songwriters on a track, and so you'll have all these fractions of ownership. Somebody will have 2%, somebody will have 5%, somebody will have 10%. And this oftentimes leads to litigation and disputes over who owes what. The Music Modernization Act, it accomplished a few different things, but the kind of the most important moving forward for the industry was trying to end some of that and just smooth the process of how these services paid songwriters.
So after that became law, there were other arguments over how much songwriters were getting. So how do things stand today, and what is the most current dispute?
So just this week, 4 of kind of the 5 big tech companies in music, Spotify, Amazon, YouTube, which is owned by Google and Alphabet, and then Pandora, which is now owned by SiriusXM, the satellite radio company, appealed a decision made in January of 2018 that kind of set the rate that that songwriters would get paid for a particular royalty. Without getting too into the weeds, songwriters get paid 2 different types of royalties from streaming services, and one of them was determined by these copyright judges last year. And the tech companies have essentially said that the process in which this happened was not right, and they're appealing. Now, Apple is not part of it. They have tried to be more friendly to the music industry, but these other 4 tech companies have all appealed and are trying to get a rehearing of what these rates should be. The music industry, of course, is saying, look at these greedy tech companies. They don't care about the songwriter. They're trying to reduce what they pay. The tech companies insist, whether you believe them or not, that they're not actually protesting the rate, but they're protesting the process in which it was determined.
So there's 2 different issues. One is the growth in the rate, and the rate of the royalty has gone up materially. But the other issue is that if you're a songwriter, that's like maybe 1 cent to 1.5 cents. So in terms of the real world, even if there have been big increases in those royalty rates, is it really meaningful to songwriters?
It's meaningful in a really small way. To your point, you know, songwriters don't make the bulk of their money from streaming or from sales. They make a lot more money when a song goes crazy on radio, or if a song gets used in a commercial or a movie, what's called a sync license. Songwriters feel that they get screwed over in the way royalties are paid out, that the bulk of revenue from a Spotify or an Apple Music goes to the recording artist and not the songwriter. Record labels collect, depending on the service and the contract, 50 to 55% of Spotify's revenue, and songwriters collect under these new rules, which was a significant increase, like 15%.
This whole dispute makes me think of something that happened in the movie business in the 1980s, and that was along with the advent of the video cassette. And the studio said, listen, this is going to cost us a lot to make and manufacture and distribute. So even though it's this new revenue source, we're only going to give screenwriters a small fraction of what these cassettes are actually bringing in. And it ended up being a deal that the screenwriters took, and it cost them hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Is there a similar argument that these distributors and streaming services are proposing now, is that we have to get a break because we're growing and we don't want to go out of business, and we might, if we don't have this advantage?
That is definitely an argument made by some of the companies. One of the reasons you'd see someone like Apple not protest is because Apple makes so much money from selling phones, so they don't really care about losing a little money on music. Spotify, whose entire business is music, needs to make money on their service, and they have certainly made that argument part of it. They're still a growing service. They're still figuring out a model that works for them. They reported a profit in their most recent quarter, but it's one of, if not the first times they've ever done that. And then to the point you're making about VHS and new technologies, there's also the record label or the music company to factor in here, because it's oftentimes the music company making the deal with the streaming service on behalf of their artists. And the three biggest music companies in the world, Universal, Sony, and Warner, all operate both record labels and publishing, which represent songwriters. And they have made the decision to tilt the scales in the favor of the recording artist rather than the songwriter.
Yeah, and those three companies control about 80% of all of licensing. So what happens next? You have these record labels that have this huge clout. You have these companies outside of Spotify that are making a lot of money. What are the possible outcomes in the dispute?
One outcome is that they decide to just keep the system as is, and all the different streaming services and tech companies have to figure out how to make money from it, how the business works. And the other is that they revisit it and they revise. Now, in the grand scheme of things, we're talking about, you know, there are some clear barriers on what the decision could be. It used to be that payment was like 10%, then it was 15% of overall revenue. It's going to be somewhere in that window. And none of it is going to completely change the game for songwriters. But songwriters were very, very happy about this ruling last year. And if all of a sudden that rate gets put down, it is just going to lead to a lot more tension between them and these tech companies, which do want songwriters to like them and work with them, because at the same time that they're trying to reduce the rate that they're paying, they're trying to convince more and more artists to work directly with them instead of go through the labels. Because the real concern for Spotify and for a lot of other music companies is how much they have to pay the intermediaries, the record labels, the music publishers. Everybody's trying to fight for a larger piece of what is a growing but still sort of small pie.
Lucas Shaw is an entertainment business reporter for Bloomberg. Lucas, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Coming up on The Frame, how a James Bond screenwriter tapped the turmoil of Northern Ireland for his Broadway hit, The Ferryman.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Playwright and screenwriter Jez Butterworth is known for film scripts like Black Mass and the Bond film Spectre, and the 2011 Tony-nominated play Jerusalem. Butterworth's latest Broadway production, The Ferryman, takes place in 1981 during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, when the country was racked by a complicated, decades-long, and often bloody political conflict over national sovereignty. Directed by stage and screen collaborator Sam Mendes, The Ferryman is set in the home of the Carney family during the Harvest Feast. Here's the character Quinn Carney, played by Paddy Considine, as he gives a toast around the Harvest table.
I want you to remember something. That a man who takes care of his family is a man who can look himself in the eye in the morning. And I hope you find as strong a rock as I have in your ma. To Mary.
Aye, to Mary.
Finally, on behalf of this entire clan, I'd like to thank Caitlin for this wonderful food and for everything she's done for this family over the past 10 years. To Caitlin.
To Caitlin.
To Caitlin.
Soon, the household discovers a missing family member has been murdered. The story was inspired by the real-life family of actress Laura Donnelly, who plays Caitlin in the play. Butterworth told me about Donnelly's uncle, Eugene Simons.
He was disappeared by the IRA in 1980, and I think his body was found by accident about a year later. I think he was the first as well. He was the first body to be discovered.
the explanation that Laura was given at the time was that her uncle had died in a car accident. Obviously, he was murdered, but something else happened, and that is that the body was hidden in a way so that the family never really knew. There's this mystery of what has happened and where these people have gone, and the idea that they might still be alive is kind of perpetuated by the people responsible.
That's right. This was a practice that the IRA began in the 1920s and stopped doing and restarted in the early 1970s. And so the idea is that if you can short-circuit the process of grief in the families and in the communities that you're trying to terrorize, it's a much better use of resources to not dump a body in the street, because the second that that body is discovered, a clock starts ticking, which will allow them at some point, hopefully, to overcome that grief or at least deal with it. If you're never presented with the actual idea that somebody has died and people are telling you this person is still alive, that process can't begin.
You made a decision, I suspect, pretty early on to set this entire tale inside a kitchen. Why was that important, and what does that mean, both for better and for worse, about what you can accomplish in one set?
Well, I think all the plays I've done have taken place in one set. I think the job of theatre, when it's done the best, conjures up an offstage that is hopefully as vivid, if not more vivid, than what you're presenting on. I've never really been a fan of those plays that jump all over. And this, by the way, you know, unfortunately, that includes most Shakespeare plays, which have, yes, a kind of sort of more filmic structure than they do a, you know, an Aristotelian structure. But I just like the idea and the challenge and the tightrope walk of staying in one place and allowing it to steep and to boil and just create this kind of pressure cooker environment. And I guess it might have something to do with the fact that I write films as well, and they can jump all over the place, but it just doesn't... I don't think it's the best use of a theatre to black out or rotate the set. If you can get that pressure cooker situation going, you can get people to imagine absolutely anything.
There is a kitchen that is central to this set, and there are meals prepared, and there are things being harvested. There's things that are coming in. There's live animals. And it's inevitable that people watching this play would say, you reap what you sow. And as a writer, how specific are you thinking about that idea visually as you're writing the story about what is happening politically off screen?
Well, I think it sort of seeps into the bones of the thing from the first phrase. These moments in the year, these times in our lives, you know, that they all of them have a literal and metaphorical resonance, and certainly the fact that this play was set at a time where the hunger strikes were in train and coming to an end. It's actually set on the day that the 10th hunger striker, Mickey Devine, starved himself to death. But once I realized that that was late summer and that it was simultaneous with the harvest, it felt that those two ideas spoke to each other in a way that I didn't really need to draw more attention to.
And it's not just crops that are being harvested, it's young boys too. They are being groomed and developed, yeah, to be soldiers. And that seems to be a very big idea and a very central part of the story that you're trying to tell.
I think so. You know, you have available to you as a writer, if you want to say something about the cyclical nature of violence, well, when you get to a third act of a play, you can begin the whole process of reaping, as you're suggesting, again. And that allows for that third act to almost feel like a flashback to what has happened to the hero and to his missing brother.
When you are doing some research for this play and you think you know about a subject and maybe you learn new things, it could be somebody writing about the Troubles, somebody writing about Israel. But when you start making sure that what you're presenting is accurate, what were some of the assumptions that you found yourself being challenged on, even by your own research?
Well, I think whenever you set a play in a historical or geographical context in which you are not or haven't been, you know, there is an onus upon you to digest absolutely everything you can about that time and that place. And that's just part of the natural process of a play. If I'm setting a play in Soho in the 1950s, as I did with my first play, or I'm setting a play in Wiltshire, you're bound at that point to have to undergo a tremendous amount of research. It's the same with films. I wrote a film called Fair Game that was about the Iraq arms crisis, and I've written films that are set in many different milieu that I, on day one, you know, I don't know the first thing about. It's one of the most exciting bits about it, actually, is just the period where you're not having to be drawn on what you feel dramatically about this subject, but you're just soaking it all up.
We're talking with Jez Butterworth about his play, The Ferryman. When you think about what people say about this play, you have critics who are assessing, you know, the performances, the playwriting, and then you have critics. There's notably somebody in The Guardian who wrote about what it had to say about Northern Ireland. What do you take away if you engage those criticisms from how different people with different backgrounds might react to a play like The Ferryman?
The extraordinary thing about that question is that everybody talks about that article in The Guardian. It's like the only one that there's been. There was this one guy.
That's true. Sean O'Hagan's his name.
Sean O'Hagan, who, if truth be known, which I can let it be known now, I knew Sean 20 years ago. He doesn't like me. He's got a very specific reason to not like me as well that I won't go into here. So, you know, I mean, I chose not to answer it. And by the way, heading in the opposite direction of that, you can look at the Irish Times, you know, who came out in support. But let's face it, I'm English. You know, if this wouldn't be a question if I weren't English, you know what I mean? And I think the idea that you must ring fence your creativity to just the parochial place that you grew up or whatever, you know, for a start, you wouldn't have any Shakespeare plays. You know, he didn't grow up in Venice and he's not from Elsinore. You know, it's just you choose these subjects, you put on these masks and you do the best job you can.
I want to ask you about something you've been working on. It seems by its title to be a total mismatch, Ford versus Ferrari. This is about the Le Mans race, I think, in 1966. Sounds like a mismatch, but I suspect in your movie, maybe it's closer than it might appear.
Well, it was a series of races that took place over the 60s where the Ford Motor Company decided when they weren't able to buy Ferrari outright and adopt their racing program, they decided to destroy them. And so Henry Ford II just threw millions and millions at a race program. And it's a fascinating story. And it's, by the way, it's a very good example of an area that I chose to go into that I knew absolutely nothing about on day one.
This is probably where Carroll Shelby becomes part of the Ford story, right?
That's right. I met with Carroll Shelby shortly before he died at his country club in Los Angeles at about 10 o'clock in the morning. And this is a man who's had, I think, two heart transplants and a liver transplant. And he was sitting there, 85 years old, 10 o'clock in the morning, drinking tequila.
I'm going to ask you this last question. When you were thinking about what you're going to do, sometimes it might be an assignment, sometimes it might be something that you're asked to do. Do you know if you're writing a play? Do you know if you're writing a movie? At what point do you make that decision?
There's never any confusion between the two. I've never found myself at the beginning of a project thinking, hang on, this should now be turned into the other form. I think I know from the get-go. The only thing they really have in common is that I select the ideas based on, if I sit alone and think about them, do they give me goosebumps?
That's the test.
That's the test. And then I don't need to know any other reason about it. I don't need to any intellectual reason or the timing of this is good or this person would be good to work with or this person is available or I'm free or I'm fascinated by the subject. If I don't sit there and just the very bones of the idea don't just fill me with a sort of a tingling, quivering sense that I'm entering into some territory that is vital, then I won't do it.
Jez Butterworth is the playwright of The Ferryman. It's on Broadway through July 7th. Jez, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed your play.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
The Ferryman is playing on Broadway through July 7th. Coming up on The Frame, the composer who wrote the score for Captain Marvel lets us in on her music writing process. Given how dominant Marvel is these days at the box office, it's hard to believe that the studio's first movie, Iron Man, was released just a little more than a decade ago. 11 years and many movies later, we've got a new release in theaters now. It's called Captain Marvel. It's the first Marvel movie with a female lead, played by Brie Larson. It's the first with a female director, Anna Boden, who co-directed with Ryan Fleck. And it's the first with a female composer, Pinar Toprak. Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited Toprak's studio and asked her about the biggest gig that she's ever had.
The last time I checked in with Pinar Toprak, she was scoring the comic book series Krypton on the Sci-Fi Channel, which was pretty rare territory for a female composer. She had this to say.
Well, a lot of things, unfortunately, are thought to be male-themed, right? This is nothing different, and we can talk philosophically about why that is. But the world doesn't change by thinking the same things, by the limitations. The world changes by thinking, okay, it's been like this for a while, but there's no reason why it needs to keep being like this. And music and art in general, it's genderless, because emotions are genderless.
Now she's the first female composer to score a Marvel film.
I'm a big Marvel fan. I'm a big fan of the whole superhero genre in general, but Captain Marvel means something more. I remember getting the call from Laura Engel, was one of my agents, and she's like, we might be able to get you an opportunity to the demo. And for me, even just that was the accomplishment right there, because I didn't actually think I was going to get it.
When a composer gets the chance to write a demo, essentially auditioning to score a movie, they normally just write music inside their computer. But for Captain Marvel, Pinar Toprak didn't go that route.
And I had the option to just either do it in the box with, you know, all MIDI mock-ups situation, or not. I went and hired a 70-piece orchestra.
You heard right, a 70-piece orchestra out of her own pocket. That's not cheap.
And it miraculously worked.
Toprak grew up in Istanbul, Turkey. She wanted to be a film composer since she was a little girl and came to the U.S. in the late 90s to study jazz and composition. She apprenticed with composers Hans Zimmer and William Ross, and over the past decade she's mostly scored indie films and TV movies, but she's recently started to blow up, writing additional music for Justice League alongside Danny Elfman, scoring the massively successful online game Fortnite, and now Captain Marvel.
She's incredibly powerful, yet she's got this really human, vulnerable side to it that doesn't take away from the strength.
Oh, I'll be out of your hair as soon as I track down the Skrulls that are infiltrating your planet.
Skrulls?
Shapeshifters. They can transform to any life form down to the DNA. Oh boy, you guys don't have any clue, do you?
Whoa, hold on. How do we know you're not one of those shapeshifters?
Congratulations, Agent Fury. You have finally asked a relevant question.
Oh, congratulations to you, Star Force Lady. You're under arrest.
Once I actually saw the film, I really felt like what I did at first wasn't unique enough. And I wanted to write a theme that was really her. Now that I got to know her a little better, I felt like, okay, I could do something better. And hopefully something that's more singable and memorable. It's the human side. It's the heart, I think. I wanted to make sure that I capture the heart somehow.
There's plenty of pressure on any composer to define a big screen superhero with a melody. Toprak was well aware of the huge legacy of super themes behind her, John Williams' theme for Superman probably being the top dog.
People are like, oh, we can't wait to hear Captain Marvel theme. We wonder what it's going to be like. So I was psyching myself out a little bit in the studio, playing a whole bunch of things. I wasn't happy with any of it. And I'm panicking. I'm never going to write a note again. You know, it's a very typical writer thing to say. So I put my shoes on. I took a walk around my neighborhood. I knew how I wanted to start the theme. I knew the first two notes.
Ta-da.
So I just started like just humming those two notes and trying a few things. And people must have thought I was crazy because I was literally like walking and humming to myself. And I came up with something that I didn't hate too much. And I called someone who's on my team, also a dear friend of mine. I was like, what do you think about this theme? So I just hummed it to him. And he was like, Pinar, hang up the phone right now and record it on your voice memo. So that's what I did. And believe it or not, that is the Captain Marvel theme now. my father passed away 10 years ago. It'll be 10 years on the release day of Captain Marvel. He supported me in ways that I couldn't have ever imagined a father could. We're not talking about financial support because there wasn't a whole lot of that. But in terms of a father believing in his daughter at such a young age, it was mid-90s in Turkey. And when I told my dad, I'm going to move to Hollywood and score Hollywood films, he didn't think I was crazy. He actually thought that it was possible. And that made everything possible.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that is it for The Frame this week. If you missed any of our shows, you can always listen by subscribing to our podcast. You can find The Frame podcast everywhere that great podcasts are found. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Andrea Gutierrez. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We're back here on Monday.